Lord, when the Lamanites could be induced to do the Mormons' bidding, they were, nevertheless, a potent weapon. While they awaited the arrival of the Federal Army, Brigham and other church leaders did their utmost to inflame passions against the Gentiles. The saints were reminded again and again of the murders of so many of their brethren in Missouri and Illinois, and how their beloved prophet Joseph Smith had been shot dead by a godless mob in Hancock County. Rumors were spread that the approaching troops had orders to hang Brigham and exterminate the Mormons altogether. As the sweltering summer of 1857 crept toward fall, observed Juanita Brooks in her courageous, groundbreaking book, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, speeches became more and more inflammatory, such speeches as have been used by patriots and zealots in many causes to stir the heart to anger and strengthen the arm for battle. From one end of the territory to the other, the people of Utah retold and relived their past sufferings, the mobbings and burnings and final expulsion from Nauvoo. They would never be driven again. They would fight first. The Mountain Meadows Massacre, published in 1950, is an extraordinary piece of work, the seminal portrait of Mormondom under Brigham Young. Will Bagley's updated treatment of the same subject, Blood of the Prophets, published in 2002, must now be considered the definitive work, but as Bagley acknowledges, he owes an immeasurable debt to Juanita Brooks, whom he praises as one of the West's best and bravest historians. In a very discernible sense, every book about the Mormon experience in 19th century Utah, published after 1950, is a response to Brooks's book, just as every post-1946 treatment of the Mormons under Joseph Smith was written in the immense shadow cast by Fawn Brody's masterpiece, No Man Knows My History. By August, hatred for the Gentiles had been raised to a fever pitch. Militias had been organized and drilled in each of the 100 towns and villages across Utah Territory. Men from distant Mormon outposts in Nevada and California had been summoned back to Utah to help defend the Commonwealth. Saints were instructed to supply no provisions whatsoever to the Gentile wagon trains that continued to roll through Utah on their way to California. In a letter distributed across the territory, Mormon bishops were admonished not to let so much as a kernel of grain be sold to our enemies. And if the wicked Gentile army somehow managed to march into Deseret, Brigham demanded to know of his saints, were they prepared to torch their own towns, burn their own crops, lay waste to and desolate everything before them? The answer was a unanimous, unequivocal yes. This was the explosive atmosphere that greeted the Fancher Company when their wagon train crested the Wasatch Range and rolled down Emigration Canyon into the Great Salt Lake Valley on August 3, 1857. Noting the intensity of the Mormon hostility, the Arkansans rested only 2 days in the territorial capital before continuing south and west on the old Spanish Trail to California. The Arkansas emigrants, it seemed, were marked as victims from the moment they entered Utah. One of them later claimed that as soon as they arrived in Great Salt Lake City, it was obvious to him that the saints were looking for an excuse to slaughter the entire train. One reason the Fancher Party may have been singled out was the Arkansans' conspicuous wealth. It was reputed to be the richest and best-equipped train that ever set out across the continent. Among the group's 1,200 head of stock were prized Texas Longhorns and a strikingly beautiful thoroughbred racehorse that was alone worth $3,000 in the currency of the day, the equivalent of many hundreds of thousands of 21st century dollars. Additionally, it was rumored that the Fancher Party was carrying a strong box filled with thousands of dollars in gold coins. In Utah, where plagues of crickets and an extended drought had left many saints contemplating starvation, such riches could not have failed to arouse the interest of people who considered it righteous to steal from the godless. But the wagon train from Arkansas was probably imperiled less by its affluence than by the saints' carefully nurtured sense of persecution, a mood that was stoked relentlessly from the pulpit that entire summer. More than ever, the Mormons wanted payback for the assassinations of Joseph and Hiram Smith, and they had just learned of another, more recent crime to avenge as well, the slaying of Mormon Apostle Parley Pratt, who had been hunted down like an animal and savagely killed in the same part of Arkansas where the Fancher train originated, just 2 weeks after the Fanchers embarked for Utah. Parley's Canyon, the valley Interstate 80 now follows between Salt Lake and Park City, the site of a ski resort and celebrated film festival, was named in honor of the martyred apostle, one of the most popular figures in Mormondom after Joseph Smith, and an estimable man by any measure. The seeds of Pratt's demise had been planted by an act of charity, when he'd provided succor to a troubled woman from New Orleans named Eleanor McLean. A recent convert to the faith, Eleanor was married to a nasty drunk, a Gentile named Hector McLean, who disapproved of her conversion and regularly beat her. Touched by Pratt's kindness, Eleanor fell in love with him, abandoned her husband, left her three children in the care of her mother, and then found passage to Salt Lake City working as a cook for a party of Mormon emigrants. Although Eleanor remained legally married to Hector McLean, in Deseret, Brigham sealed her to Parley Pratt for time and eternity, making her the 12th of the apostles' plural wives. In 1856, while Pratt was in St. Louis doing missionary work, she returned to New Orleans and absconded with her three children, inducing murderous rage in her first husband, who blamed Pratt for wrecking his marriage. McLean set out in hot pursuit of Pratt and managed to intercept a letter from Pratt to Eleanor, in which the apostle described his plans to meet her on the Arkansas River. Armed with this information and working in cahoots with a federal marshal who hated Mormons, McLean had Pratt arrested and jailed in Van Buren, Arkansas. The non-Mormon magistrate assigned to hear the case quickly saw that the charges against Pratt were without merit. Concerned that the Mormon apostle would be lynched by vigilantes if he remained locked up, the brave magistrate surreptitiously released Pratt, but McLean was notified immediately by jailhouse spies. The obsessed McLean and two accomplices tracked Pratt down 12 miles outside of Van Buren, where they stabbed him, shot him for good measure, and then left him by the side of the road to slowly bleed to death. Afterward, McLean boasted that killing Parley Pratt was the best act of my life, and he was cheered as a hero across western Arkansas for the deed. He was never arrested or charged with any crime. After her husband's death, Eleanor Pratt gradually made her way back toward Utah, destitute and dispirited. On the trail near Fort Laramie, she crossed paths with Porter Rockwell, who gave her a ride to Great Salt Lake City as he hurried to inform Brigham on Pioneer Day of the invading army. About the time the Fancher wagon train was crossing the border into Utah territory, Eleanor delivered a detailed account of her husband's murder to the leaders of the church. Her report heaped blame on the entire state of Arkansas and implored the saints to avenge Parley's innocent blood. On August 3, 1857, the same day the Fancher train arrived in the Great Salt Lake Valley, Apostle George A. Smith, first cousin to Joseph Smith, who held the rank of general in the Nauvoo Legion, rode out of Great Salt Lake City in a carriage bound for southern Utah. 6 years earlier, General Smith had led the settlement of this distant corner of the territory. St. George, the largest city in southern Utah, was named after George A. Smith. The saints who had colonized the region under his direction were known to be the most fanatical in all of Mormondom. The general paused to address the brethren in every town he passed through, inflaming their fanaticism to even greater levels, urging the southern settlements to prepare for holy war. By late August, Smith was completing the outermost arc of his swing through the South, where he visited Jacob Hamblin, the Mormon leather stocking, a gifted missionary to the Lamanites who had built a summer cabin just a few miles north of the Mountain Meadow. Renowned for his rapport with the Indians, Hamblin was especially respected by the region's Paiutes, who treated him as a father figure. Smith delivered a letter to Hamblin from Brigham Young, dated August 4th, in which the missionary was told that the Indians must learn that they have either got to help us or the United States will kill us both. Around the same time General Smith met with Hamblin, he also had a long powwow with the hundreds of Paiutes on the Santa Clara River, some 20 miles from the Mountain Meadow, employing John D. Lee as his interpreter. According to Lee, Smith told the Indians that the Americans had a large army just east of the mountains and intended to kill all of the Mormons and Indians in Utah Territory, that the Indians must get ready and keep ready for war against all of the Americans and obey what the Mormons told them to do, that this was the will of the Great Spirit. Afterward, as the Mormons were riding away from the powwow, Smith told Lee, "Those are savage-looking fellows. I think they would make it lively for an emigrant train if one should come this way." If such a wagon train did arrive in the area, Smith then asked Lee, did he think the saints of the southern settlements would join the Indians in attacking it? Would the brethren pitch into them and give them a good drubbing? Lee gave the question careful thought, then answered, I really believe that any train of emigrants that may come through here will be attacked and probably all be destroyed. This reply, Lee said, served to cheer up the general very much. He was greatly delighted and said, I am glad to hear so good an account of our people. God will bless them for all that they do to build up his kingdom in the last days. I have always believed since that day, Lee wrote of this conversation 20 years after the event, that General George A. Smith was then visiting southern Utah to prepare the people for the work of exterminating Captain Fancher's train of emigrants, and I now believe he was sent for that purpose by the direct command of Brigham Young. Shortly after this, Smith hurried back to Great Salt Lake City with Hamblin and about a dozen Paiute leaders in order to meet with Brigham. On the night of August 25th, as they were on their way north, Smith, Hamblin, and the Indians actually camped within shouting distance of the southbound Fancher wagon train, and three of the Arkansans walked over to visit with the Mormons. In reply to the emigrants' query about where they might rest and graze their massive herd of livestock before striking out across the Mojave Desert, Hamblin recommended a lovely little valley near his cabin called the Mountain Meadow. The notorious conference between Brigham Young and the Paiute chiefs took place in Great Salt Lake City on the evening of September 1st. It lasted for about an hour, with Brigham's son-in-law, Dimmick B. Huntington, acting as interpreter. According to Huntington's notes of the encounter, Brigham explicitly gave the Indians all the emigrant cattle on the old Spanish trail, that is, the Fancher's prize herd, which the Paiutes had covetously gazed upon when they'd camped next to the emigrants exactly 1 week earlier. The prophet's message to the Indian leaders was clear enough. He wanted them to attack the Fancher wagon train. The morning after the meeting, the Paiutes left the City of the Saints at first light and started riding hard for southern Utah. The Arkansans passed through Cedar City, 35 miles north of the Mountain Meadow, on September 4th, where they asked to buy food from the Saints but were pointedly refused. By this time, Cedar City was a craze of fanaticism, one Mormon resident recalled, where numerous false rumors had been circulating about the Fancher train. It was said, for example, that some of the emigrants had directly participated in the murder of Mormons at Hahn's Mill, Missouri, in 1838, and that one of the Arkansans had bragged that he was among the mob that had killed Joseph Smith. As far as the Saints of southern Utah were concerned, the emigrants were the personification of evil. According to John D. Lee, on or around the day the Arkansans arrived in Cedar City, he received orders to attack the emigrants from Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Haight, the mayor of Cedar City, president of the LDS stake, and commander of the local battalion of the Nauvoo Legion. Lee was told to gather the Indian chiefs who had met with Brigham 3 days earlier, arm their warriors, and lead them in an ambush on the Fancher train in the mountains south of Cedar City. Lee reported that Haight had emphasized that this directive was the will of all in authority. On September 5th, Lee headed for the Mountain Meadow with a large contingent of Saints and Paiutes. They arrived in the hills above the meadow on September 6th, where they hid among the stunted trees and watched the Arkansans make camp near the spring below, and the Saints painted their faces so they would look like Indians. The next morning before dawn, while the emigrants were sleeping, these painted Mormons and the genuine Paiutes stole toward the Fancher camp and took cover behind rocks and brush. As the sun crept over the serrated 10,000-foot crest of the Pine Valley Mountains, the unsuspecting Arkansans gathered to cook breakfast. Lee's snipers carefully aimed their muskets to inflict maximum casualties, then fired. Lee had assumed the Arkansans would quickly succumb to the surprise assault. The Saints had been so confident of a quick victory, in fact, that they had promised, in Lee's words, that the Paiutes could kill the emigrants without danger to themselves. But the Fancher party was disciplined, very brave, and well-armed, and their ranks included many expert riflemen. After the initial volley of gunfire, the Arkansans quickly circled their wagons, dug into bunkers, and then immediately initiated a counter-assault, utterly confounding their attackers. At least one Paiute brave was killed that morning. Two Paiute chiefs were mortally wounded, and the Indian and Mormon forces were decisively repulsed, dealing a completely unanticipated blow to their resolve. As they regrouped at a safe distance, the Indians expressed their displeasure with the bungled operation in no uncertain terms. They threatened angrily to go home and leave the Mormons to their own devices. Now we knew the Indians could not do the work, Lee was forced to acknowledge after their surprise attack failed, and we were in a sad fix. After ordering his men to keep the emigrants pinned down, Lee rode off to summon Mormon reinforcements and to seek the counsel of his superiors. Down in Cedar City, Isaac Haight had heard by Monday afternoon that things were not going as planned on the Mountain Meadow. Haight was itching to send a deputation of Mormon militiamen up to the high country to finish off the emigrants, but vocal members of the community argued that such a grave action shouldn't be undertaken until they'd received the explicit endorsement of Brigham Young. That evening, Haight dispatched a rider on a fast horse to Salt Lake City, bearing a letter to the prophet explaining that Lee had the Fancher Party surrounded at the Mountain Meadow and asking what should be done with them. In the meantime, the Mormons and their Paiute mercenaries kept pressure on the Arkansans by harassing them with sniper fire, preventing them from collecting water from the nearby spring. By now, having glimpsed numerous fair-skinned men among those shooting at them, the emigrants had probably deduced that their attackers included Mormons as well as Paiutes. Hungry and tormented by thirst, the Gentiles knew that their situation was growing increasingly grim. Their ammunition was running out. They could neither bury their dead nor provide much comfort to the many who were seriously wounded. Most of their horses and cattle had been driven off by the attackers, but some 60 animals had been killed in the crossfire. The carcasses of these beasts were now putrefying around the Arkansans in the late summer sun, creating a sickening stench. On the night of September 10th, two bold emigrants made a desperate attempt to sneak through the siege lines and summon help. One of them, a 19-year-old artist from Tennessee named William Aiden, who had joined the Fancher train in Provo just a few weeks earlier, somehow made it out of the meadows and had ridden to within several miles of Cedar City when he came upon a group of men camped beside a spring. Believing them to be another party of Gentile emigrants en route to California, Aiden rushed into their midst and blurted out a plea for help. The men, however, were Mormons, not emigrants, and upon hearing young Aiden's appeal, they drew their weapons and shot him dead. Isaac Haight's messenger had arrived in Salt Lake City early that same morning and promptly turned around to carry Brigham's reply back to southern Utah. The prophet's instructions were that the saints must not meddle with the Fancher Party. "The Indians," Brigham wrote, "we expect will do as they please, but you should try and preserve good feelings with them." This letter has been intensely pondered by scholars, yet historians remain sharply divided about what Brigham really intended by it. The actual text of Brigham's letter remains in some doubt, because the original has disappeared, along with almost every other official document pertaining to the Mountain Meadows massacre. The excerpt quoted above is from a purported draft of the letter that didn't surface until 1884, when an LDS functionary came upon it in the pages of a church letter book. Whatever its meaning, the missive didn't arrive in Haight's hands until September 13th, 2 days after the Mountain Meadows massacre had been carried out. In the absence of word from Brigham Young, Isaac Haight sought guidance from his immediate superior, Colonel William Dame, the 38-year-old military commander of all the southern Utah militias. Haight rode 20 miles north to the settlement of Parowan, where he woke Dame in the middle of the night to ask him what to do about the besieged Fancher train. Colonel Dame impatiently insisted that Haight needed no further word from Great Salt Lake to take decisive action. "My orders," Dame declared, "are that the emigrants must be done away with." This directive was conveyed to John D. Lee at the Mountain Meadow by Major John Higby of the Nauvoo Legion, a 30-year-old zealot who arrived on the scene with more than 50 elite militiamen from Cedar City. By the night of September 10th, most of the Paiutes had ridden away from the Mountain Meadow in disgust, leaving the Saints with perhaps as few as 40 Indian mercenaries. Fearing that they no longer had sufficient manpower to overwhelm the emigrants' position by force, the Saints decided to end the standoff by means of subterfuge. The next morning, September 11th, Lee sent an English convert named William Bateman toward the encircled emigrants under a white flag. Bateman was instructed to tell them that the Mormons were there to intercede with the Indians on the Arkansans' behalf and would escort them to safety past the hostile Paiutes if the emigrants would hand over their weapons. After Bateman indicated that the emigrants were willing to parley, Lee approached the emigrant stronghold to arrange the terms of the surrender. "As I entered the fortifications," Lee reported, "men, women, and children gathered around me in wild consternation. Some felt that the time of their happy deliverance had come, while others, though in deep distress, and all in tears, looked upon me with doubt, distrust, and terror." It took Lee at least 2 hours to win the emigrants' confidence, but eventually, seeing no alternative, they agreed to his terms and gave up their weapons. The youngest children and several of the wounded were placed in a wagon and driven away. They were followed on foot by the emigrant women and the older children. A few hundred yards behind this group, the men of the Fancher Party were led away in single file, with each emigrant escorted closely by a Mormon guard. After approximately 30 minutes, Major Higbee, bringing up the rear on horseback, discharged a firearm to get the Saints' attention. "Halt," he ordered according to a prearranged plan. "Do your duty." At this infamous command, each of the Mormons immediately fired a bullet point-blank into the head of the captive under his purview. Most of the emigrant men died instantly, but one of the Saints recalled seeing an apostate Mormon, one of the backouts who had joined the Fancher train in Utah and was a close acquaintance of the Mormon executioners, lying wounded on the ground, pleading to Higbee for his life. According to a Mormon witness, Higbee told the apostate, "You would have done the same to me, or just as bad," and then slit the apostate's throat. Another Saint who participated in the massacre later reported that while the men from the Fancher Party were being executed by their Mormon escorts, the women and children were attacked by the Indians, among whom were Mormons in disguise. Painted Saints and Paiutes rushed upon these victims with guns and knives and began shooting and bludgeoning them to death and slashing their throats. An Arkansan named Nancy Huff, who was 4 years old at the time, later reported, "I saw my mother shot in the forehead and fall dead. The women and children screamed and clung together. Some of the young women begged the assassins after they had run out on us not to kill them, but they had no mercy on them, clubbing their guns and beating out their brains." According to Nephi Johnson, a Mormon who later confessed his own culpability to historian Juanita Brooks, white men did most of the killing. The slaughter was over in a matter of minutes, leaving an estimated 120 emigrants dead. Approximately 50 of the victims were men, 20 were women, and 50 were children or adolescents. Out of the entire Fancher wagon train, only 17 lives were spared, all of them children no more than 5 years old, deemed too young to remember enough to bear witness against the Saints. Those children not killed were taken to Mormon homes to be raised as Latter-day Saints. Some were placed in the households of the very men who had murdered their parents and siblings. In 1859, an agent of the federal government managed to find all 17 survivors and return them to their Arkansas kin. But before handing the kids over, their Mormon keepers had the audacity to demand thousands of dollars in payment for feeding and schooling the youngsters while they were in the Saints' care. When quiet settled over the killing field, the Mormons looted the corpses for valuables. After the Saints had gathered what they wanted, they allowed the Indians to take the rest. The dead emigrants were soon stripped of everything, including every shred of clothing they'd been wearing. Very little of the plunder went to the Indians, however. According to historian Will Bagley, the Paiutes only got about 20 horses and mules, while the Mormon officers claimed the best animals for themselves, a measure of contempt for their allies. In the desperately poor country of southern Utah, the spoils of the slaughtered immigrants became a source of envy and conflict. Some of his neighbors felt that Lee had swindled them out of their share. Colonel William Dame and Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Haight, whose orders had prompted the slaughter, arrived at the mountain meadow from Cedar City on the morning after the killing had ended. It was the 45th birthday of John D. Lee, who escorted his commanding officers to the site of the butchery, where they were confronted with the naked, horribly brutalized bodies of men, women, and children, scattered across the landscape in twisted poses of rigor mortis. "Colonel Dame was silent for some time," recalled Lee. "He looked all over the field and was quite pale and looked uneasy and frightened. I thought then that he was just finding out the difference between giving and executing orders for wholesale killing. Dame expressed shock at the carnage and tried to absolve himself of any responsibility for it. This infuriated Haight. "You ordered it done," he spat back at his superior officer. "Nothing has been done except by your orders, and it is too late in the day for you to order things done and then go back on it." Confronted with this irrefutable statement of fact, Dame lost his composure and appeared as though he might burst into tears. According to Lee, Dame vehemently protested, "I did not think there were so many of them, or I would not have had anything to do with it." Losing his patience with Dame's lack of spine, Haight turned to Lee and said, "Colonel Dame counseled and ordered me to do this thing, and now he wants to back out and go back on me, and by God, he shall not do it. I will blow him to hell before he shall lay it all on me. He has got to stand up to what he did like a man. He knows he ordered it done, and I dare him to deny it." Having no adequate answer for this charge, Dame fell silent and turned his attention to supervising the disposal of the corpses. The Mormon militiamen, Lee reported, piled the dead bodies up in heaps, in little gullies, and threw dirt over them. The bodies were only lightly covered, for the ground was hard, and the brethren did not have sufficient tools to dig with. Within days, wolves and other scavengers had unearthed the dead emigrants from the shallow graves and scattered their remains across the meadow. Upon completion of this half-hearted, hastily undertaken burial, according to Lee, the saints gathered in a circle at the site of the mass murder to offer thanks to God for delivering our enemies into our hands. Then the overseers of the massacre reiterated the necessity of always saying the Indians did it alone, and that the Mormons had nothing to do with it. It was voted unanimously that any man who should divulge the secret, or tell who was present, or do anything that would lead to a discovery of the truth, should suffer death. Chapter 19. Scapegoats. Brigham Young saved his church when Joseph was lynched, brought it to the Missouri, took it to Great Salt Lake, gave it safety, wealth, and power. The state of Utah is his monument. He was a great man, great in whatever was needful for Israel, great in understanding, in will and fortitude and resolution, in finding the means which others could not find, great in remembering also, in the command and management of men, the opposition and hostility and Haight. A great leader, a great diplomat, a great administrator, and, at need, a great liar and a great scoundrel. Bernard DeVoto, The Year of Decision. "Look, over here," shouts 6-year-old Randy Bateman. A pint-sized tornado with a pertinacious blonde cowlick, he kneels in the dirt to prop up a rock with one tiny hand while gesticulating furiously with the other. "Come see," he yells again with even greater urgency. "A scorpion hole." A minute later, he's deftly plucked the sinister-looking arachnid from its lair and placed it in an empty Gatorade bottle. Then he scurries up the trail in a burst of dust to show off the prize to his father, Deloy Bateman, the Colorado City teacher who has apostatized from the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. As the crow flies, Colorado City is less than 50 miles from the site of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. William Bateman, the Mormon who approached the Fancher party under a white flag at the Mountain Meadow in order to arrange the false truce that persuaded the emigrants to surrender their weapons and walk into John D. Lee's homicidal trap, was Deloy Bateman's great-great-great-uncle. Several saints who took an active part in the 1857 slaughter were the forebears of modern Americans of some renown. Current Utah Governor Mike Leavitt, for example, is a direct descendant of massacre participant Dudley Leavitt, as was Juanita Leavitt Brooks, the author of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And among the descendants of John D. Lee are members of the Udall political dynasty. Stuart Udall was a 3-term congressman from Arizona and served as U.S. Secretary of the Interior under President Kennedy. His younger brother, the late Morris Udall, succeeded Stuart to serve 15 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives. And Morris's son, Mark Udall, currently represents Colorado's 2nd District in the U.S. House. Although Deloy isn't proud of his ancestors' notorious role in the massacre, he believes it shouldn't be swept under the rug. To the contrary, he'd like to know all there is to know about it. "I've always been a curious person," he says. even when I was still in the religion. Uncle Rulon has always restricted what the people in Colorado City can learn and what books they can read, but that actually kind of runs against the grain of what Joseph Smith originally taught. In D&C 90, I think it is, there's a revelation from Joseph which says something like, "Study and learn and become acquainted with all good books." In any case, I've always been interested in learning as much as I can about everything I can, and I've tried to instill that same love of learning in my kids. The Bateman clan is on a weekend camping trip planned around a climb of Mount Dellenbaugh, an extinct volcano that stands at the southern edge of the Arizona Strip. The objective of the ascent is to track down a 132-year-old signature said to be etched on the rim of the crater that forms Dellenbaugh's rocky crest, a signature that may help explain a puzzling series of events that happened in the aftermath of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and might conceivably have involved some of Deloy's ancestors or their cohorts. In addition to Deloy and Randy Bateman, the team presently en route to the summit includes one of Deloy's two wives and nine more of his 17 children. Four other kids, a grandchild, and a son-in-law have stayed behind at base camp in support. Because today's expedition includes Deloy's two six-year-old boys, Randy and Kevin, and his two eight-year-old daughters, Maria and Sarah, the pace up the mountain is less than brisk. The kids are strong hikers and completely at home in this unforgiving environment, but they stop constantly to peer under rocks in search of snakes and other interesting creatures, or to marvel at desert plants and identify geologic specimens. "I encourage it," Deloy says with an unapologetic shrug. "The idea is to turn every trip outdoors into a biology lesson." The only problem is, by the time the party finally arrives on the summit, the sun is within minutes of disappearing behind the majestic curve of the western horizon, leaving precious little daylight for locating the signature Deloy hopes to find. The top of Dellenbaugh is a spiky crown of basalt swept by a hot, dry wind. Hundreds of giant megaliths bristle from the summit crater, and any of them might conceivably be imprinted with the relevant graffito. Finding the right rock before the mountain is swallowed in darkness seems like a long shot, but should the expedition fall short of its goal, the view from the top is a fine consolation. To the south, the earth is covered in a rolling sea of piñon and scraggly juniper that washes right up to the very lip of the Grand Canyon, which appears as a huge, shadowy gash rimmed with cliffs of pale kaibab limestone. Just before daylight vanishes altogether, somebody yells, "Here it is!" And lo, scratched onto a brownish, flat-faced chunk of basalt the size of a washing machine, is the name Deloy has been looking for, faintly but unmistakably printed in crude, inch-and-a-half-high letters, W. Dunn. Immediately below is the date 1869 and an arrow pointing north toward the Utah line. "I'll be darned," Deloy exclaims. He brushes his fingertips across the inscription, then looks up to consider what the man who carved his name into this rock would have seen more than a century earlier from this mountaintop. The inscription was made by one William Dunn, a shaggy-haired mountain man not yet 30 years old, whose buckskin clothing was distinguished by its dark, oleaginous luster. This latter description comes to us from Mr. Dunn's employer at the time, Major John Wesley Powell, the eminent explorer of the American West, celebrated for making the first descent of the Grand Canyon. Dunn, a member of that astounding expedition, vanished with two companions, the brothers Oramel Gass Howland and Seneca Howland, near the conclusion of the journey. Dunn's signature atop Mount Dellenbaugh is the last trace of the missing explorers known to exist. After taking a few photos of Dunn's etching, Deloy and his family admire the view from the summit for as long as the twilight lingers, then descend to their camp beneath a sky smeared with stars. The next morning, on their way back to Colorado City, the Bateman caravan unexpectedly rolls past a memorial to the lost men from Powell's expedition, and Deloy pulls off the road to examine it. The handsome wooden sign declares, "William Dunn, O.G. Howland, and Seneca Howland, after leaving Major Powell's party, came up Separation Canyon and crossed over Mount Dellenbaugh. They were killed by Indians east of this marker the last of August, 1869. The memorial reflects the prevailing view of what happened to Dunn and the Howland brothers. Deloy has recently arrived at a different opinion, however. He has decided that the three explorers were murdered not by Native Americans, but by the Mormons of southern Utah, and the bloodshed, he believes, stemmed from an unfortunate misunderstanding that grew out of the Mountain Meadows massacre. In 1858, a year after the massacre, Brigham Young reluctantly agreed to admit federal troops into Utah and to step down as territorial governor, bringing an end to the threat of all-out war between the Saints and the United States. But persistent rumors that Mormons had committed unspeakable atrocities against the Fancher wagon train kept drifting up from the southern settlements, threatening the fragile peace. President Buchanan's Secretary of War ordered Army Brevet Major James H. Carleton to investigate the matter. Arriving at the Mountain Meadows in the spring of 1859, Carleton was sickened to discover that nearly 2 years after the event, the valley was littered with skulls, bones, clumps of women's hair, and scraps of children's clothing bleaching in the sun. An army surgeon reported that many of the skulls bore marks of violence, being pierced with bullet holes or shattered with heavy blows or cleft with some sharp-edged instrument. The nature of the bullet wounds, he concluded, showed that firearms had been discharged close to the head. "There has been a great and fearful crime perpetrated," Carleton declared. His soldiers gathered up whatever bones they could find, interred them in a common grave, and then laboriously hauled stones from the surrounding hillsides to build a massive, if crude, monument above it. At the apex of this rock pile, which was 12 feet high and 50 feet in circumference, they placed a wooden cross inscribed with the epigraph, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord." In May 1861, Brigham Young happened upon this memorial as he was passing through the meadow during a tour of his southern settlements. According to Apostle Wilford Woodruff, who was accompanying the prophet, when Brigham read the inscription on the cross, he pondered it for a short while, and then proposed an emendation. "Vengeance is mine," the prophet smugly asserted, "and I have taken a little." A moment later, one of the saints in his entourage threw a rope over the cross and pulled it down, while others began dismantling the stones and scattering them. By the time Brigham's party departed the Mountain Meadows, the monument to the slaughtered emigrants had been obliterated. Things had lately been looking up for the kingdom of God, leaving the prophet in a cheerful frame of mind. The territorial governor installed by President Buchanan as Brigham's replacement, a bureaucrat from Atlanta named Alfred Cummings, had turned out to be a patsy who was easily manipulated to do the saint's bidding. The despised Buchanan, moreover, had himself been replaced in the White House by Abraham Lincoln. After taking office, Honest Abe told a Mormon emissary, "You go back and tell Brigham Young that if he will let me alone, I will let him alone." Brigham thus had good reason to be in an expansive mood. The Saints' capital city had even become a popular travel destination for intrepid luminaries from afar, including the French botanist Jules Remy, the famous newspaperman Horace Greeley, and the English explorer Sir Richard Francis Burton. Greeley, the most influential journalist of the era, had interviewed Brigham in 1859 and then published a largely favorable piece in the New York Tribune, noting that the prophet spoke with no apparent desire to conceal anything and had no air of sanctimony or fanaticism. After Sir Richard Burton rubbed shoulders with Brigham, Porter Rockwell, and other Mormon eminences in 1860, the celebrated English adventurer had written, "The prophet is no common man, and he has none of the weakness and vanity which characterize the common, uncommon man. There is a total absence of pretension in his manner, and he has been so long used to power that he cares nothing for its display. The arts by which he rules the heterogeneous mass of conflicting elements are indomitable will, profound secrecy, and uncommon astuteness." Such flattery from prominent Gentiles no doubt buoyed Brigham's disposition, but most of his ebullience was attributable to the advent of the Civil War. The momentous conflict erupted at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, just a month before his 1861 tour of southern Utah, inspiring in the prophet an attitude of renewed insolence toward the United States. When federal troops were yanked out of Utah to buttress the Union forces fighting the Confederacy, he couldn't have been happier. All the news from the East, moreover, seemed to confirm that the Gentile nation was teetering precariously on the brink of self-destruction, exactly as Joseph Smith had prophesied back in 1832. On December 25, 1832, Joseph received a revelation, later canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants as Section 87, in which God explained that civil war will shortly come to pass, beginning at the rebellion of South Carolina, which will eventually terminate in the death of many souls. For behold, the southern states shall be divided against the northern states, and it shall come to pass after many days, slaves shall rise up against their masters, who shall be marshaled and disciplined for war. And thus with the sword and by bloodshed the inhabitants of the earth shall mourn, and with famine and plague and earthquake and the thunder of heaven and the fierce and vivid lightning also shall the inhabitants of the earth be made to feel the wrath and indignation and chastening hand of an almighty God until the consumption decreed hath made a full end of all nations. Although their bitterness toward the government in Washington, D.C. moved the Mormons to cheer each Confederate victory on the battlefield, Brigham was certain that Union and Confederate forces would eventually annihilate each other, leaving the Latter-day Saints triumphant and unmolested when the Civil War came to an end, eagerly awaiting the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Seeing no reason to doubt this outcome, Brigham felt assured that the United States would no longer be meddling in the affairs of Deseret. His confidence, however, proved to be distressingly short-lived. Just 16 months after Union forces pulled out to fight the Confederacy, President Abraham Lincoln replaced them with a regiment of California infantry to ensure federal control of Utah. For the remainder of the war, according to historian D. Michael Quinn, some of these troops literally had their guns trained on Brigham Young's home, so that if there was going to be a civil uprising, his home would be the first to receive cannon shots. Compounding the prophet's woes, in 1862 Lincoln signed into law the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, which had been drafted specifically to punish and prevent the practice of polygamy in the territories of the United States and to disapprove and annul certain acts of the territorial legislature of Utah. Just months after taking office, Lincoln demonstrated that he intended to be at least as tough on the Mormons as Presidents Fillmore, Pierce, and Buchanan had been before him, prompting Brigham to lash out against such cursed scoundrels as Abe Lincoln and his minions. Which is ironic because the second Mormon prophet shared many of the attributes that distinguished the 16th American president. Had Brigham's life been diverted onto a different track, had his ambitions been less millennial and more secular, it is easy to imagine him in the White House. He certainly had what it takes to become president, and he would have made a memorable one, a national leader in the mold of Lyndon Johnson, say, or Franklin Roosevelt, or even Lincoln himself. In April 1865, Brigham's comforting pipe dream of the North and South mutual destruction came to an end with the surrender of General Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. The Civil War concluded with the Union not only intact, but in important ways stronger than ever. Brigham was forced to acknowledge that the United States would thereafter be increasingly involved in the business and governance of Deseret. This eventuality was underscored in 1869 with a ceremonial driving of the Golden Spike at Promontory Summit, near the north end of the Great Salt Lake, marking completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. Now all that separated Utah from the ungodly reach of the whole Gentile nation was a relatively short, comfortable train ride. And 1869 also saw another major event that signified the end of Utah's isolation— the first descent of the Green and Colorado Rivers by Major John Wesley Powell, a Civil War hero who had lost his right arm at the Battle of Shiloh. Powell's expedition cast off in puny wooden boats from Green River Station, Wyoming, on May 24, 1869, planning to float the Green River to its confluence with the Colorado River. In those years, it was called the Grand River rather than the Colorado— then continue downstream through the treacherous, completely uncharted chasms of the Grand Canyon, thereby traversing the last vast expanse of unexplored wilderness in the contiguous United States, the final blank spot on the map. It was a trying voyage marked by danger, hardship, and acrimony between Powell and some of his men. On August 27th, near the lower end of the Grand Canyon, the boatmen beached their vessels on the riverbank immediately above what would turn out to be the last set of dangerous rapids on the entire journey. Seneca Howland, his brother Oramel Howland, and William Dunn announced that they were leaving the expedition. Ignoring Powell's pleas that they remain with the main group, the three disgruntled adventurers told him they intended to climb 4,000 vertical feet from the river to the canyon's north rim, then walk across more than 100 miles of barren desert to the Mormon settlements of southern Utah. By this point, the expedition had traveled nearly 1,000 perilous river miles. All 9 men were battered and hungry, and they had only 5 days of provisions left, mostly consisting of dried apples and coffee. The party's greatest problem, however, was the rift that had developed between Major Powell and his mentally unstable brother, Captain Walter Powell, on the one hand, and 5 free-spirited trappers on the other. Dunn, the Howland brothers, Jack Sumner, and Billy Hawkins. The 9-man expedition also included a melancholic Civil War veteran named George Bradley and 20-year-old Andy Hall. Both these men maintained good relations with the 2 disputatious factions. The expedition had embarked from Green River with a 10th member as well, Englishman Frank Goodman, but after Goodman's boat capsized and he nearly drowned in Disaster Falls, he told Powell on July 5th that he had seen danger enough and left the expedition, well before the group entered the Grand Canyon. As Wallace Stegner noted in his classic biography of Powell, Beyond the 100th Meridian, the major and his brother represented military discipline and the officer class, while the 5 trappers represented frontier independence and a violent distaste for discipline of any kind. On August 28th, after Dunn and the Howland brothers watched their companions crash through Separation Rapids and then disappear around a bend in the river, the 3 deserters began the arduous climb out of the Grand Canyon, carrying 2 rifles and a shotgun, a duplicate set of expedition papers, and a silver watch Jack Sumner had asked them to deliver to his sister in case he drowned. Dunn and the Howlands ascended a steep gulch, later named Separation Canyon, to reach the North Rim, then set out across the Shivwitz Plateau. 30 arduous miles from the river's edge, they climbed the gentle slopes of an extinct volcano, now called Mount Dellenbaugh, in order to get their bearings and plot a course across the harsh country that stretched ahead of them. On Dellenbaugh's 6,990-foot summit, Dunn scratched his name on the face of a boulder, and then the trio presumably headed north for the Mormon settlements. Nobody knows for sure, though, because Dunn and the Howlands never reappeared. Evidence corroborating the authenticity of Dunn's inscription atop Mount Dellenbaugh was discovered in 1995. A young man from Cedar City named Wynne Isom was looking for arrowheads on the eastern slope of Mount Dellenbaugh, well off the trail, when he caught sight of a little glint on the ground, perhaps 30 feet away. It turned out to be a thin piece of badly tarnished brass, 2 inches long and just over 1 inch wide, with the name William Dunn engraved on its face in cursive script. From indentions at the plate's corners, it appears to have been riveted to a gun stock, perhaps, or some leather article that belonged to Dunn. After Powell and the rest of his team had made it through Separation Rapids without flipping their boats, they pulled ashore, waited about 2 hours, fired guns, and motioned for the Howlands and Dunn to come on, Jack Sumner recalled, as they could have done by climbing along the cliffs. The last thing we saw of them, they were standing on the reef, motioning us to go on, which we finally did. 2 days after floating away from the 3 deserters, Powell's group arrived safely at the confluence of the Virgin River, where they encountered a group of Mormons netting fish. The Saints generously fed the emaciated explorers, then escorted Powell over the Beaver Dam Mountains to St. George, the principal city of southern Utah. On September 8th, as Powell was traveling via carriage from St. George to Great Salt Lake City, a story appeared in the Deseret News, the Mormon newspaper, under the headline, 3 of the Powell Expedition Killed by Indians. We have received a dispatch through the Deseret Telegraph line from St. George of the murder of 3 of the men belonging to the Powell Exploration Expedition. It appears, according to the report of a friendly Indian, that about 5 days ago the men were found by peaceable Indians of the Shebet, Shivwit, tribe, very hungry. The Shebets fed them and put them on the trail leading to Washington in southern Utah. On their journey they saw a squaw gathering seed and shot her, whereupon they were followed by 3 Shebets and killed. A friendly Indian has been sent out to secure their papers. The Telegraph does not give us the names of the men. When Powell heard the news, he refused to believe that Dunn and the Howlands had been killed by the Shi'vwits, a retiring, relatively small band of Indians belonging to the southern Paiute Nation. His skepticism was based largely on reports that the woman who had allegedly been raped before she was murdered was alone and unarmed. "I have known O.G. Howland personally for many years," Powell explained, "and I have no hesitation in pronouncing this part of the story as a libel. It was not in the man's faithful, genial nature to do such a thing." The first report of any kind that Dunn and the Howland brothers had been killed by Indians was the mysterious telegram alluded to in the Deseret News story. The telegram had been sent anonymously to Mormon apostle Erastus Snow in St. George on the evening of September 7, 1869, shortly after Powell had passed through town and asked the local saints to keep a sharp eye out for the missing members of his team. The telegram read, "Powell's three men killed by three Shi'vwits 5 days ago, one Indian's Day journey from Washington. Indians reported that they were found in an exhausted state, fed by the Shi'vwits, and put on the trail leading to Washington, after which they saw a squaw gathering seed and shot her, whereupon the Shi'vwits followed up and killed all three. Two of the Shi'vwits who killed the men are in the Washington Indian camp with two of the guns. Indian George has gone to secure what papers and property there is left." Jack Sumner, one of the expedition members who had emerged safely from the Grand Canyon with Major Powell, and a close pal of William Dunn and the Howland brothers, didn't see eye to eye with Powell on most matters, but he shared the Major's skepticism that Indians had killed their companions. The night after separating, the men who had stayed on the river with Powell had speculated around their campfire about the fate of the three men left above. According to Sumner, everyone else in Powell's group seemed to think the Red Bellies would surely get them. "But I could not believe that the Reds would get them, as I had trained Dunn for 2 years in how to avoid a surprise, and I did not think the Red Devils would make open attack on three armed men. But I did have some misgiving that they would not escape the double-dyed White Devils that infested that part of the country. Grapevine reports convinced me later that that was their fate." Sumner was, of course, talking about the Mormons of southern Utah. He knew all about the Mountain Meadows Massacre and the Mormons' continuing insistence that Indians alone had been responsible for the murder of the Arkansans, despite ample evidence to the contrary. When Sumner heard the Mormons claiming that Indians had killed his friends, he was skeptical. Later he reported, "I saw some years afterwards the silver watch I had given Howland during a drunken brawl with some white men, one of whom had a watch and boasted how he came by it. Such evidence is not conclusive, but all of it was enough to convince me that the Indians were not at the head of the murder, if they had anything to do with it." A year after emerging from the Grand Canyon and departing Utah for his home in Chicago, Major Powell, now an international celebrity, returned to the region to conduct further explorations of the Colorado River and its tributaries. In the interim, he had been contacted by the Howland brothers' family, who implored him to find out what had really happened to Oromil and Seneca. Toward these ends, Powell sought the assistance of Brigham Young, who volunteered his main man in southern Utah, Jacob Hamblin, Indian missionary extraordinaire, to serve as Powell's guide. On September 5th, Powell rendezvoused in Parowan with Brigham, Hamblin, and approximately 40 local saints, including two of the leading perpetrators of the slaughter at Mountain Meadows, William Dame and John D. Lee. The entire group accompanied Powell as far as the Mormon outpost of Pipe Spring, where Powell and Hamblin bid farewell to Brigham and the other saints and headed south across the Arizona Strip with an escort of Kaibab Indians. On the evening of September 19th, just north of Mount Delenbaugh, Hamblin arranged a parley between Powell and members of the Shi'vwit tribe who had supposedly killed his men. According to Powell's account of the meeting, the Shi'vwit chief, relying on Hamblin to translate for him, freely confessed that, "We killed three white men." Another member of the tribe then explained, outside of Powell's hearing, that Dunn and the Howland brothers had stumbled into the Shi'vwit's village, almost starved and exhausted with fatigue. They were supplied with food and put on their way to the settlements. Shortly after they had left, an Indian from the east side of the Colorado arrived at their village and told them about a number of miners having killed a squaw in a drunken brawl, and no doubt these were the men. In this way, he worked them into a great rage. They followed, surrounded the men in ambush, and filled them full of arrows. The murders had resulted from a terrible misapprehension, in other words. Powell forgave the Shi'vwits and made no effort to punish them or take revenge. Over the years, a handful of voices persisted in challenging this version of the tragedy, most prominently those of Dunn's friend Jack Sumner and a grizzled Colorado River guide named Otis Doc Marston, who claimed he had heard from a Mormon privy to confidential information that it was the Mormons that shot these men. But Sumner, Marston, and the other skeptics were roundly dismissed by the majority of historians and scholars, Mormon and Gentile alike, including such eminences as Wallace Stegner. Then in 1980, a former dean of the College of Science at Southern Utah University, a Latter-day Saint named Wesley P. Larson, came across a letter that had been squirreled away for 97 years in an old trunk in the hamlet of Tokerville. Dated February 17, 1883, the letter suggested that Dunn and the Howlands had been killed in Tokerville, inside the LDS ward house, no less, by one of the local saints. The letter was written to John Steele, a highly respected judge and ecclesiastical leader, as well as Tokerville's preeminent doctor and bootmaker, by William Leaney, Steele's friend of 37 years. Leaney had been a faultless saint. He had once even been a trusted bodyguard to Brigham Young until the volatile, hate-soaked summer of 1857, immediately prior to the Mountain Meadows Massacre, when he'd committed the unforgivable sin of providing food to a Gentile member of the Fancher wagon train as it passed through Parowan. The Gentile in question was William Aiden, the 19-year-old artist from Tennessee who would be shot a week later trying to summon help for the besieged Arkansans. Aiden was the son of a doctor who years earlier had saved Leaney from the clutches of an anti-Mormon mob that threatened to do him mortal harm in the town of Paris, Tennessee, where Leaney was serving as a missionary. Following his rescue, Leaney was taken to the Aiden residence where he met young William. Recognizing the Aiden boy when the Fancher party stopped for the night in Parowan, Leaney invited him into his home, gave him dinner, and then sent Aiden away with some onions from his garden. Upon learning of this treasonous act, William Dame dispatched a thug to Leaney's house, who pried a post from Leaney's fence and clubbed him in the side of the head with it, fracturing his skull and nearly killing him. In 1883, when he wrote the long, rambling letter discovered by Professor Larson, Leaney was 68 years old. The correspondence to Judge Steele was apparently prompted by a suggestion from the judge that before he passed into the hereafter, Leaney might want to repent for certain sins some of the Tokerville brethren had accused him of committing. Leaney replied angrily that God shall bear me witness that I am clean of all of which they accuse me, and they guilty of all that I accuse them, and much more. What Leaney accused his fellow saints of, the letter revealed, was thieving, whoredom, murder, and suicide, and like abominations. He reminded Steele, moreover, that you are far from ignorant of these deeds of blood from the day the picket fence was broke on my head to the day those three men were murdered in our ward and the murderer killed to stop the shedding of more blood. Five paragraphs later, Leaney made another allusion to the killing the three in one room of our own ward. Baffled and intrigued by these provocative references to murder, Wesley Larson deduced from historical records that the killings alluded to by Leaney had occurred in 1869. Then he determined that only three men had been murdered that year in southern Utah, William Dunn and the Howland brothers. But why would the good saints of Tokerville want to take the lives of three wayward explorers? Tokerville was founded in 1858, a year after the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and most of the first families to settle there were headed by men who had participated in the slaughter. Many of these same men were living in Tokerville in 1869 when Powell floated down the Grand Canyon. The year prior to Powell's expedition, Ulysses S. Grant had been elected president, and his administration had made it a priority to capture the perpetrators of the massacre and bring them to justice. Even before this new dragnet, moreover, a $5,000 bounty had been placed on the heads of Isaac Haight, John Higbee, and John D. Lee. By the time Dunn and the Howlands decided to abandon Powell's expedition and walk to the Mormon settlements, many of Tokerville's leading citizens were living in constant fear of arrest. The climate of paranoia that pervaded the region was at a particularly high pitch in the summer of 1869, thanks to Brigham Young, who had made a trip through southern Utah that season, stoking hatred for the Gentiles. Cautioning that federal troops were about to launch a new invasion of Deseret, Brigham ordered sentries to stand watch at strategic points along the territory's southern border. This was the volatile atmosphere that awaited Don and the Howlands as they walked north from Mount Dellenbaugh toward the Mormon settlements. Larson speculates that somewhere on the Shivwitz Plateau they encountered one or more Mountain Meadows fugitives, who assumed that Powell's men must be federal agents or bounty hunters. Their preposterous claim to be harmless explorers who had just completed the first descent of the Grand Canyon, which was known by everyone in Utah to be completely impassable, would only have confirmed their treacherous intentions in the eyes of the saints. So, according to this scenario, the Mormons hauled Dunn and the Howlands into Tokerville, where they were tried by a kangaroo court and summarily executed. Within a few days of this presumed lynching, Major Powell happened to turn up in St. George, asking